Hey, Ford Alliance, our extended digital family. I want to just start us today with a question. What level is your joy at in these days? Or maybe we can go back even over a broader spectrum. How about what level is your joy at over these last couple of years? Now, I would imagine even me just asking you guys that might bring up thoughts like this. Pastor, what the heck? Do you not know what's been going on in the world? It's been a crazy season. And you're asking me, how's my joy? Let me just be honest. Like I don't miss the irony of that question. I get it. I realize that, you know, for some of you, you've been ill. Probably some of you watching, like, quite seriously ill. Some of you have, like, tragically lost loved ones. Some of you have had seasons, long seasons of just feeling alone and isolated. And here I am asking, like, what level is your joy at? Come on, Pastor. I don't miss the irony. In fact, as I think back to these last couple of years, for me, one of my most heartbreaking moments was with one of my boys. You here, maybe you online have come to learn. We moved here as a family a few months before the season of COVID. Just as we're starting to make friendships, if you will, everything goes and shuts down. And as a province, as a country, and then within around a year or so in, really, like, we were in the midst of a real strict kind of lockdown season, if you will. And it was one of my boys' birthday at this point in time. And I went to take him to bed that evening and tuck him in. And I just said, hey, your birthday's coming up. What are we going to do to celebrate? And my son, who is normally super excited and, like, loves to party, if you will, just looks at me and says, nah, nothing. We don't need to do nothing, Dad. I was like, no, but it's your birthday. Like, we should do something to celebrate. What do you want to do? And he just says, can't even go to grandma and grandpa's. I don't even know anybody in my school. I can't see friends from church. Like, I don't need to do nothing, Dad. I don't even really have friends, he says to me. And my heart just, like, sunk in that moment. Like, I quickly wrapped up. I just laid him down. I prayed over him. I let him know it wasn't his fault. I went to my room and I just shut the door, and I'm a grown man sitting on my bed, and I just started crying for my son. This is a heartbreaking dad moment. To which hopefully you're now thinking, yeah, then. How about then, Pastor? How was your joy then? Good question. Hold it. I'm going to circle all the way back and we're going to come right to that. Before you get too sympathetic towards my boys, they are good kids. They have big hearts. They are also little monsters. Just the other day, we're driving down the road. They're in the back of the truck, and it's getting a little noisy, getting a little loud. I look into the mirror, and I look back, and they're leaning over, and I see one of them. Poof, and I'm like, hey! Don't hit your brother. And he hollers back at me. I didn't hit him, Dad. And I go, son, I literally just saw. I looked in the mirror. I saw it. I'm an eyewitness to what just took place. You are guilty. Now sit up straight. Look for both of you and keep quiet. A couple of you have had experiences like that. Which he has the gall to go, it was a push, Dad. Sheesh, little monsters. Oh, man. Nonetheless, we are going to circle all the way back at the end to joy. And so hang on that. But to get to joy, we're going to talk through eyewitness reality. The book we come to, 1 John, is an eyewitness account. It is someone who has witnessed and saw and heard and touched Jesus. And he wants us to get it. He wants to like us to press into this reality and to better understand what relationship, or what we've called in this series, fellowship with God, with others, and even as we'll get into a little bit next week, with self looks like. And so we're going to get into 1 John from this very perspective. It goes like this at the very beginning of it in 1 John chapter 1, verse 1. We proclaim to you the one who existed from the beginning. We spent a whole, you know, sermon, if you will, last week on the beginning. And it's going to come out even more why I'm so convinced he wants to go to the very beginning. But then he gets into this eyewitness language that I don't want us to miss. Whom we have heard and seen. We saw him with our own eyes and touched him with our own hands. The Apostle John, the author of this letter, he wants us to realize that he himself has seen it. He has heard it. He has touched him. He wants us to understand this is the perspective he brings to us. And so when he says, look, I seen you hit him, he meant it. I saw it. And then he rose and I touched him. Like, he wants us to get that. He was there. And this is so important as we get started, that we have an eyewitness to Jesus. And so this confirms with us the significance of the understand the perspective of why our fellowship with God and with others and with self, it really does matter. In our day, one of the kind of best or one of the leading kind of thinkers and minds around this idea of the significance of having an eyewitness is Lee Strobel. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Lee Strobel, he was an investigative journalist and someone who was not a follower of God, didn't believe in God at all, in fact. And his wife found Jesus. His wife came to faith. And he then wanted to use his investigative journalism, abilities and talents to press into this reality of who is God and who is Jesus, to disprove it, to show that it's false, it's not real. And in the course of pressing in to disprove God and faith in Jesus, he actually found God and he actually came into relationship, into fellowship with Jesus. And so that's a Lee Strobel story. I want to actually use a clip of his right now and just to allow him to explain from his perspective, for himself, why this reality of understanding we have an eyewitness account here really matters. So here's Lee Strobel's thoughts on the significance of an eyewitness that we have here as an example in 1 John.
I like to look at the evidence for the resurrection in four categories. The first one is, did Jesus die on the cross? Was he dead? Virtually every scholar on planet Earth concedes that Jesus was dead after crucifixion. We have no record of anyone anywhere ever surviving a full Roman crucifixion. Even the Journal of the American Medical Association published a peer-reviewed scientific medical study of the evidence for the death of Jesus and said clearly, the weight of the evidence indicates that Jesus was dead even before the wound to his side was inflicted. Even the atheist New Testament scholar, Gerd Ludemann, says, historically, it's indisputable that Jesus was dead. So Jesus was dead. The second category of evidence is the early accounts we have for the resurrection. In other words, I used to think as an atheist that the resurrection was a legend, and that took a long time to develop in the ancient world. But what I learned is that we have preserved for us a creed of the earliest Christian church, a creed that is an eyewitness-based report of the resurrection of Jesus. Now, this creed has been dated back by scholars to within months of the death of Jesus. Within months. That is historical gold. So we've got a news flash from ancient history on the resurrection. Third category of evidence is the empty tomb. And the best evidence for that is even the opponents of Jesus implicitly admitted the tomb was empty. Because when the disciples began proclaiming that Jesus had risen, what the opponents said was, the disciples stole the body. Now they're conceding the tomb's empty, they're just trying to explain how it got empty. So everybody's conceding the tomb was empty. How did it get empty is really the issue. And that goes to the fourth category of evidence, which is eyewitnesses. You know, for most of what we know about ancient history, It comes from one or maybe two sources of information. And yet, for the conviction of the disciples that they encountered the resurrected Jesus, we have no fewer than 9 ancient sources, inside and outside the New Testament, confirming and corroborating the conviction of the disciples that they encountered the risen Christ. That is an avalanche of historical data. So you put all that together and you have a really good case for Easter.
So we have here in 1 John an eyewitness. And this matters. It's someone who's seen it at the source. And he desperately, as you will hear in these verses, wants us to get, he's seen this, he heard this, he felt this, he touched this, and the why behind it. So we proclaim to you the one who existed from the beginning, whom we have heard and seen. We saw him with our own eyes and touched him with our own hands. He was the word of life. This is so, so significant for us. I know I've touched on this next thought real quick before in the past, but I bring it up because it applies to right here. He is the word of life. Notice the personification of what is happening here. And this is no spoiler alert. You know where this is heading. We're about to see Jesus named in just a moment. But he, Jesus, is the word of life. This is a phrase so significant to John. He uses it in his gospel account as well. And we went back and even mentioned his gospel last week, right? In the beginning was the word. The word was with God. The word was God. He takes us to the beginning. And he uses the word, and this is so strategic for us. The word is actually the word logos. He is the logos of life. For John's Jewish audience who'd come to faith, this would really land because the logos, the word of God, was just held with the utmost highest respect. They saw it as a source of total and complete authority. After all, in the beginning, God created, and he did so how? He spoke. Right? He spoke. The power and the authority of God's word matters to his Jewish audience. But this word, or this word logos, also matters to his secular audience, his Greek audience. To a Greek scholar, they would have seen the word logos as the originating power or force that brought the cosmos into existence. And so this lands for John's first century audience. When he says in the beginning, and he takes them to the beginning, and then says he was the word of life, he was the logos of life. There's this full capturing of the reality that for his Jewish audience, this is the ultimate authority. And for his Greek audience, the ultimate power that would form the cosmos. He is the word of life. He is the logos of life. John wants us to see here with complete clarity that Jesus was pre-existent. And he was central to the creation account that we spoke of last week in Genesis. He wants us to recognize that Jesus was God. God in flesh. In John chapter 1, verse 14, he says, "And the word," or the logos, "became flesh and dwelt among us. And God took the form of a human and dwelt among us." And later on, in the book of 1 John, we'll re-get back to this reality. He wants us to get it. Jesus was God as a human being. This one whom, verse 2, this one who is life itself was revealed to us, and we have seen him. And now we testify and proclaim to you that he is the one who is eternal. He was with the Father, and he was revealed to us. Again, you see John emphasizing, right, that he is an eyewitness to this, an eyewitness to God in the flesh. And he identifies it and brings it out here. He was with the Father. And now we here speak to how he, Jesus, has been revealed to us. It goes on, verse 3, we proclaim to you that we ourselves, he emphasizes it again, have actually seen and heard. Now we get to the heart of what I want to get to. So that you may have our word for this whole series, that you may have fellowship with us. John writes, because he wants us to have fellowship with one another. Remember last week, that relationship that was broken, that fellowship that was broken with others? Jesus has now come to restore that fellowship, to restore that broken relationship. So that you may have fellowship with us, and then as if to make sure we don't miss it, and our fellowship, there it is again, is with the Father and with his Son, here's the name now, Jesus Christ. He wants us to have fellowship with him. He wants us to have fellowship with others. And that fellowship flows out of our fellowship with the Father, our fellowship with Jesus, or as we said last week, our fellowship with God. This fellowship, back in Genesis, it was broken. It was fractured. And God never intended that to be the case. He designed us, as we talked about, to walk with him. He didn't walk away from us. We walked from him. And God didn't want us to be left off to our own sinful way, our own addictive tendencies, our own evil thinking and tendencies. Instead, he came. Jesus, the Logos, who was pre-existing, came, took on flesh, showed what it would mean to walk with God again, then ultimately laid down his life that we could be forgiven and come back to him, to walk then in relationship with him. If you've yet to come to that place, it begins by just acknowledging to Jesus that you are sorry, that you turned and walked away. Jesus, I'm sorry for my sin. Jesus, will you forgive me? Now, Jesus, here, my life is yours. This is what he desires for you. God longs for there to be restored relationship, restored fellowship with him. And that defines our fellowship with others. He wants us to know him, be in fellowship with him, and to know and be in fellowship with his people, the Jesus people, if you will, a Jesus people who follow the Jesus way, who walk the Jesus walk. This is his heart. Why? Verse 4. We are writing these things so that you may fully share our joy. In some of your translations, it's going to say that our joy, or that your joy, may be complete. This fellowship he calls us into, he leads us into, that he longs to have with us, that we are then to extend unto others, is to be a fellowship that is marked by a joy that is full. This word joy is the Greek word chara, spelt like chara, yes, the hockey player, Larry, which is kind of ironic when you think about it. But nonetheless, it means to have full delight or great joy, or to be filled to its fullest measure of joy. And John wants us to have that. And he writes of it. He speaks of it as if it's possible and attainable. Which brings me right back to how we started. What level is your joy at? In this season, How's your joy? Where is your joy at? Let's go back to that question. How about then, Pastor? When you were sitting on your bed in tears over your son, how was your joy then? Glad you asked. There's great confusion around the difference between happiness and joy. See, happiness is based on happenings. And in that moment, I was a man who was saddened. But that didn't shift or didn't change the fact that I could still be a man full of joy or complete in my joy. Why? Because I have this ever-growing reality that I'm so more and more daily aware of, that I am in fellowship with God. I walk with Jesus. And I walk with Jesus as I do so with his people and fellowship with them. And so I was able to sit in my bed at that moment and cry, but still know the certainty of the joy I had and who I am in Jesus and the fellowship I have with him and his people. And we got to separate happiness from joy. Happiness is based on happenings, but joy is a choice. And it comes with a fullness and a completeness. John doesn't just write about this in the book of 1 John. I think it's worth bringing this out. He speaks of it throughout the Gospel of John too. Jesus says this in John 15, which is one of my wife's favorite passages in all of Scripture. The whole of it is so good, but 9, 10, and 11 is where I'll end. I have loved you even as the Father has loved me. Remain in my love, or abide in my love. Hey, abide, by the way, is a great wordle word, just in case you're one of those people online, just so you know. Anyways, it's the one my wife uses. Abide in my love. When you obey my commandments, you remain in my love, just as I obey my Father's commandments and remain in his love. Here we go. I have told you these things so that you will be filled with my joy. Yes, your joy will overflow. It's a message that's dear and it's significant to John, an eyewitness of Jesus' life. A message that he wants us to get. Where's our joy at? Where is your joy at? And maybe you just think I'm just being the eternal optimist in this, and that's fine. I would rather be an eternal optimist than a pessimist and down and negative on this thought. But I really believe John wants us to press in, have fellowship with God, enjoy fellowship with others, because he's writing these things so that you may fully share his joy. And so the question I started with, I wrap up with. Where's your joy at? And maybe one of the questions that's worth also using as a barometer is this. How's your fellowship with God? How's your fellowship with his people? Those are linked. How's your joy? Or what level's your joy? How's your fellowship with God? How's your fellowship with others? Now maybe you're thinking, what does fellowship with God look like? How do I do it? Here's a great starting point. 1 John is a beautiful place to start. Take time in your day. Sit down and read a couple verses of it. Look for a word or a phrase that stands out to you. Read it again. Highlight that word or that phrase that stands out to you. And then sit down and talk to God about it. Ask him, hey, Jesus, this is the word that stands out to me. What do you want me to have, you know, what do you want to bring to light in my life around that word today? Just dialogue via prayer with him. Because he longs for that. He would love to have that type of fellowship with you. You can do that tomorrow. Just start 1 John 1:1-4. Write down a passage, pick a word, and talk to Jesus about it. Because he, John, is writing these things so that you may fully share our joy, that your joy be complete. And Jesus wants that for you in this season.